Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 4th of March. Our guest this hour has written an interesting piece. We are not headed to socialism or heading to socialism. Robert Brent Toplin is our guest, professor of history at the University of North Carolina. And he says during the presidential race of 2008, Republicans often invoked a fear of socialism. John McCain warning about the danger in his speeches and his campaign ad suggests Barack Obama's economic plan sounds a lot like socialism. And since, of course, Obama has taken the oath of office, pundits on the right have amplified this theme. But our guest says that warnings about a swift American turn in the direction of socialism are mistaken. We're going to be talking about that issue this first hour of our program today with Professor Robert Brent Toplin. He has published a dozen books, among them Radical Conservatism, The Right's Political Religion, Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11, How One Film Divided a Nation. Some of his earlier books include History by Hollywood, The Use and Abuse of the American Past, an edited work, Ken Burns, The Civil War, Historians Respond. Robert has been a principal creator of historical dramas that have appeared nationally on PBS television and the Disney Channel, and he joins us this first hour of our program. I think we'll get a lot of calls on this topic, so let me early on give you the phone number and invite you to join us whenever you'd like. It's 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@wpr.org, and we welcome you to the show. Thank you, Professor Toplin, for being with us. Hello?
Yes, I'm
there. You are. Hi. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Good morning.
Tell me how this word socialism became our new scare word. Why is it all over the place all of a sudden?
It serves politically very nicely to summarize a sense of fear and something scary that might be developing. In the past, we've used words such as communism in the Cold War days and terrorism more recently, and now socialism is suddenly popping up. It did so in the campaign, as you mentioned, in your initial comments. And since Obama's been elected, it's been almost a chorus. We're hearing Cal Thomas saying we're heading for a socialist system. He's a popular journalist. Sean Hannity talked about the European Socialist Act of 2009, speaking about the stimulus plan. And so many others are doing it. But what really shocked me is when I saw it on the front page of Newsweek. We are all socialists now. Mm-hmm. So it seemed like the term is creeping into our mainstream discussion. This would be a big surprise to the early socialists in American history or even European history because they thought of capitalism as a monstrous system, and they really had a solution that was something that we wouldn't share today, the idea that government could take over, become the owner and the manager of the great industries, the great corporations. They'd be nationalized, and it would all be so wonderful. It was a great dream. Capitalism so exploitative. Now the workers would be treated well, and the goods of society would be distributed equally, and everything sounded just great. We all know today that that doesn't work. State-run industries are not the way to go. The free enterprise system is something we all embrace here in America, pretty much, most of us. And so my final point really is that the economists and the Democrats and some Republicans who have been supporting these efforts to rescue our economy, they're not calling for real socialism, certainly not. Socialists would eagerly want to replace capitalism with something different. And what we have today is an effort to rescue an economy that is in bad shape right now.
So the other phrase we've been hearing is what the president is doing is saving capitalism. Would you agree with that?
Yes, in many ways, that's what's going on. I gave it a name. I just tried to think of something better that we could use, and it might be called welfare capitalism. The idea here is that it's almost like a person is in trouble and lost a job and is hurting at the time, so we come in with emergency funds to support that person, in this case corporations, great industries, and our hope is that in time they will get on their feet, get a job in a sense, which means really return to profitability, and then we will have break loose the ties and set them on their way. Mm-hmm. Our goal certainly is not the socialist goal of hanging on, of permanently making these industries the property of the United States government, and that the government bureaucrats would run these organizations for year after year.
The other way we've attached the word socialism is to the healthcare system in this country and attempts to change this system. We've attached that word socialism for a national healthcare plan for years to that effort.
That's certainly true. Back in the days when the Clintons were trying to propose a new healthcare program, the point of attack was to call it socialism, and Harry and Louise came along to warn us about the dangers in the television commercials. That was the word that seemed to work in that case. But even our modern healthcare changes that we may have with Obama and others, it probably will not lead to socialism because we'll still have doctors as in their own form of private enterprise, their own business activities. Our hospitals are, by and large, private hospitals. We're not talking about the government running the affair. And if you wanted to talk about, you know, where do we have a little example of socialism, you might say, without using the term typically, our post office system, at least. The employees are paid by the government, and the government runs the postal system. But this is different.
Mm-hmm. And you could also say, as a letter in the editor of today's New York Times, the government does pay for police departments and law enforcement agencies and the military and schools in this country. So there is an element of, I don't know what label you want to put on it, but heavy involvement by the government in a lot of areas that make this country work.
Sure. And a lot of people are very happy with those efforts. We like our military. We like our VA hospitals, which in a sense are run by the government. So there's plenty of positive feeling towards some of these things. But when you call them socialism, you scare the heck out of the population. I'll just give you one example of the way language is so important here. We've had some recent polls asking people, how do you feel about a temporary government takeover of some of these businesses in order to, you know, to save them? And 54%, a majority, said, yes, that sounds all right. But when you say, how about a temporary nationalization of these businesses, only 37% support it, because once you get into nationalization or socialism or something like that, suddenly the hair goes up and people perspire and it gets to be a very negative reaction.
Well, people are also perspiring because they're a little worried about this massive amount of money that's going into some financial institutions, and those institutions keep coming back to Congress and saying, oh, we need more money, we need more money, so they're getting billions and billions and billions. Are we worried, and should we be worried about the U.S. government taking a stake in some of these financial institutions that have really been run poorly, and, you know, the people at the top are living these extravagant lifestyles? It doesn't sit well with us.
Exactly. And, of course, we're angry. And poor Bernanke, our Federal Reserve leader, just the other day was trying to say, I'm angry, too.
Right,
I feel your anger. I feel your pain,
right,
in a sense, because we're all just so frustrated with this. And we're, in a sense, it feels like, at least, that we're rewarding those who made bad decisions. However, Bernanke and other people who are leading the way in this effort, they're understanding that we've got a crisis. It's nothing we want to do. We don't want the government to come in with these huge public funds, the taxpayers' dollars, to rescue these operations, but we're all in this together. And if various big institutions, especially financial institutions, start collapsing, we'd all be in a terrible fix, and it would hurt all around. So what is so difficult for them to explain is the idea that we're doing this not to make big business folks who made mistakes earn new profits. We're trying to help us all. That's difficult to communicate, but that's the nature of the situation. Even Henry Paulson was acting in this way, and he was perspiring during the crisis of November of last year and so on. And here's the guy who was the head of Goldman Sachs and, certainly dyed-in-the-wool capitalist, and he was saying, we've got to come to the rescue and spend a lot of money, the TARP funds and all that. It wasn't pretty. It wasn't the best solution that we want, of course, but in the emergency, even he was saying, we have to act to protect everything. And in some ways, it turned bad, but it wasn't as bad as it could have been.
You also, Professor Toplin, wrote that a few have detected socialist goals in legislation that limits the bonuses of top executives at the companies that are receiving those TARP funds. Is there socialism in that, or what is that, and is it a good policy?
Well, it's a democratic reaction. It's the public's anger that makes a lot of sense. The public does not want to pour their valuable funds into these rescue efforts and see that at the same time, the executives are delivering huge bonuses to their people and to themselves. So they're trying to put some limits on that while the public funds are in use. And most folks can understand that and go along with it. They don't call it socialism, though some might throw out that nasty word to identify what's going on, but not really. So this is just a very understandable effort to put some limits on the problems we see, and this is one of the most embarrassing examples. For example, the fellow from Merrill Lynch, who delivered wonderful rewards to his people after they led the company into such a disaster, and that kind of news is what led to this reaction.
Yeah, that kind of news can make you mad. What about what we've been hearing, and I'm not sure if this has changed in the few weeks since we've talked about this, what about all these firms, though, that we have helped out with all of our money, and they don't seem to be doing very much with it? They're sitting on this money instead of stimulating the economy and giving out loans, et cetera. What do you call that system?
it's getting us frustrated, of course. We're trying to loosen credit. The credit has just about frozen. And so we tried these various efforts. We gave them funds. We hoped that they had some capital support then at the foundation, and therefore they'd have, you know, the freedom to start loaning more, and they haven't done enough. Well, there was not much oversight, and so we're trying new efforts now and the new plans to demand that the monies go out. And it's just a difficult situation because everybody, including the private businesses, everybody seems to be fearful now about putting money out there in the market and not getting back the return they want. In fact, the possibility of losing funds is very much on everybody's mind. So the private industries are not very confident. That's one of the reasons why we've come up with these big public programs, spending on infrastructure, spending on new healthcare design, and all kinds of things. The hope is that through government, we will have the stimulus we need to get things moving again, because the private world is just too fearful right now. And understandably, folks don't see the better days in the future. They're hoping they will come, and the expectation of the government leaders is that maybe these stimuli will make the difference. But it goes back to that old idea of John Maynard Keynes, the economist who was so important back in the 1930s especially. And his idea was that sometimes there's this fear that grows and it becomes paralyzing. And so industries, businesses, commerce, folks in these big enterprises suddenly pull back. They won't act. And so it's the job of government then to step in and to get things moving again, to prime the pump, to stir the economy through public spending. And that then gives payment to people who are working. They may work on building bridges or fixing roads or whatever it may be, greenhouse programs that will help the climate perhaps, new work on ways to get us past fossil fuels. All kinds of activities may then put people to work. They will go out and head to the stores, start spending, and through government stimulus then, you've got things moving. Then the business leaders will see, aha, we've got an economy that's coming back to life again. Mm-hmm. We can make some profits. We'll loosen up the credit. We'll take chances again, and that's what we're looking for. Now, this is, you know, sounds like a beautiful picture of progress, but that at least is the basic hope we have in trying to do these things. It's painful. It's difficult to accept because the public, we're hurting, and we don't want to pay for this in the future, but the judgment is that this is a good investment. Right now, you invest in this deficit, in a sense. You spend, and the payoff in the long run could be much better than sitting here and doing nothing. If we do nothing, we may have a lot more pain.
I remember the president, Professor Toplin, saying everything is moving so rapidly. It seems like it was just yesterday that he said this, that he'll be able to note some progress and success if there are 3 million jobs saved or 3 million jobs created as a result of all of this spending. Yesterday, I was hearing a different kind of figure. Would you agree that that's the mark by which we judge success here and we're on the right road? If we fall short of that, are we in trouble? Are we in deeper trouble?
We're certainly, we hope that the job creation will make a difference, and because that, again, inspires some hope. A lot of this is about psychology. The public and people around the world have suddenly lost faith, and they're pulling back. So job creation will be one criterion for judging success, but we're losing a lot of jobs so fast that you may create a bunch, and you're only breaking even.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the worries we have. So how do we know we're really doing well? One sign will be that the markets will start to grow again, that we'll start to see the stock market level off and maybe a little more confidence, and people will be jumping back in thinking, wow, these price-earnings ratios look just terrific, and chance to make a profit here, and let's jump in and take advantage. And we'll see that the housing market has begun to turn around. That'll be a measure of success, of course, and fewer foreclosures. Right now we have a big problem in the housing market, and we haven't seen the bottom yet. But these are the various signs of some progress, and jobs. But job creation will be one of the slower examples of the progress, because we're going to create a lot of jobs with the stimulus program. But still, with all this sense of crisis, there's been so much pulling back. Many people have been released. Many are on part-time now rather than full-time. And so that will be a slower example of a sign of progress.
We're going to welcome phone calls. All our lines are busy right now, so just keep the number in mind, 800-486-8655. Our guest is Professor Robert Brent Toplin. He's a professor of history at the University of North Carolina and has written a piece that grabbed our attention, "We Are Not Heading to Socialism." To you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, and let's start with Bob from Milwaukee. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, Professor. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My perspective on it is I'm a self-employed individual, and I don't think I need to go into the sacrifices and the risks I've taken to get where I'm at. My wife and I are fortunate enough to be among the top 2% that are going to have their taxes raised as a result of Obama's current tax plan. So we're seeing an increase in our tax combined with lowering of our income. Obviously, my business is down. My wife and I prudently purchased our home. We purchased something we could afford. And we've seen a loss in the equity of our home, substantial loss. We've had a loss of income. Now we have an increase in our taxes. Combine that with the loss of our stock holdings, we've suffered a tremendous economic loss to our overall wealth. And to watch the C-SPAN the other night, when the head of HUD is answering questions before a Senate Health Committee on restoring the equity of the individuals who are right now failing on making their mortgage payments, restoring their equity, from my perspective, it's very difficult to see how this is not a distribution of wealth.
All right, Bob. Thanks so much for your call. Professor Toplin.
Thanks. A very good point, Bob. And this was relates in a way to the angry comments we heard on CNBC when one of the leaders there was complaining about a related concern. And so the point is that people such as Bob are self-employed, they're taking risk, worked hard, were responsible toward everything. And it is an understandable sense of frustration when you see we're rescuing people who took out bad mortgages, taking on loans that they really couldn't afford to pay in the longer run. So this is difficult. The answer that those who are defending these current policies are offering is that, look, we're all hurt by, for example, this foreclosure problem. What happens is your neighborhood gets into trouble. We often see the values are going down, in part because other homes are failing and the signs are going up, the government's taking over, whatever, the industry is taking over, the mortgage company. So we got all these problems they're hurting the whole neighborhood. So in other words, we're all hurting from this. It's pulling us all down. Therefore, we are sometimes rescuing people who took out loans they shouldn't have taken, but it helps us all in the long run. We're not just helping that one person. And also, many are arguing that the programs were so complicated And the information was so complex that people didn't quite understand what they were doing. And so some of the responsibilities on that deregulation that came in the mortgage industry, where so many of these subprime loans could be offered, and there was not much effort to check them, to stop them. And so it's not just the problem of the person who took out the loans. It's also the problem we have here of those who were making these loans and packaging them and then selling them off to investors in this country and abroad. And this created a huge, huge problem. So again, it's this idea that we're all in the same boat. We're in this together. And so even though it's frustrating for those of us who have tried to manage our finances carefully and balance our books and not do more than we should have done, we may have to rescue some, just like we're rescuing companies that made bad decisions. We may do it in order to help us all.
Bob talks about being in the upper 2% of income earners in this country. Do you think the president has no choice but to raise the taxes of people in the upper 5%?
I think the president's looking at the situation, realizing that some changes regarding taxes have to come. We're taking action through debt, of course, but we have to raise some taxes. So the question is, where do you do it? And the judgment of Obama and some of his supporters would be this, that in the 90s, we had higher taxes on the very wealthy. They weren't exorbitant. They weren't terribly burdensome. The economy was booming at that time. Things were going all right, so it was all right. But we're, in a sense, returning to those times of the later 90s when the very rich, the top 2%, maybe top 5%, took on a heavier tax burden, but not an excessive one. And that's where we seem to be going back toward at this time. We're not trying to make them pay the full price of all this by any means. We have had a tremendous change since the late 90s where we reduced the taxes of the top 2%. And we've had much, much greater inequality since the late 90s. It's been very, very evident. And in the end, that hurts us all because what it's led to in part is that the great masses they've had to pay some of the tax burden, though it's kind of quiet. You don't realize it's happening, but that there it was. And in the end, they're not having the purchasing power to keep our economy going. And those people have pulled back, and we need them in action, too. So in the end, what the Obama team has been doing is giving some tax break to the to most of those who are making less than, $250,000 a year or something like that. And the hope there is that they will feel then some increased amount of money in their paychecks and go out and head to the supermarket and every other place and start spending again.
Head to the supermarket and we hope some other places, too.
That's right.
That might be fun for them. Let's go to Brian from Milwaukee. Hello, Brian.
Hello, how are you doing?
All right, how are you?
Yeah, you've already pointed out a little bit that, all industrial countries, including ours, are at least some degree socialist, and it's just a matter of degree. But I think the unrestrained capitalism that we've had is kind of like that old Indian tale where the scorpion takes a ride across the river on the back of the fox, and halfway across he stings him, and the drowning fox says, "Why, you're going to drown now, too." And the scorpion says, "You knew it was in my nature." But my point is that you just touched on it, too, that over the last 10 years especially, if you look at the top 2, the top 2 to 1%, their incomes have increased as much as 10% a year, where the average inflation-adjusted worker has actually gone down. The wealth has transferred to those people. I'm worried. Why isn't anybody talking about an oligarch that's forming where, the money is being concentrated? We know what happens with, Tsarist Russia and France and, during their revolution and down in Nicaragua and El Salvador. There's extremes to this, and why aren't we talking about that? And I think the American people are shooting themselves in the foot by saying, we don't want socialism, but, they're getting pulled into an oligarch. So my question up here.
All right. Thanks, Brian.
Good point from Brian. There's a danger when you get to extremes, people then will go for extreme solutions. And there might be an interest in old-fashioned socialism from some. We're not hearing much of it now, but that's a problem. So what are the two difficulties he points out? One of them is that since the 1980s, really, the working public has not really made significant gains at all. They've been sort of treading water. And in the late 90s, it was a brief time when they started to go up and get some real gains on income over inflation and everything, but then it got back down again. So really, since the 1980s, the working folks in America have not made real progress, while the top 2, 3, 4% have made substantial progress. And that's causing tension and difficulties and frustration. So to head off such problems, we want to start working on that now. The second thing he mentioned is that we've had sort of unrestrained capitalism. And I would interpret that to mean a lack of regulation. And in other words, regulation is another one of those words that can get our hair up and get us excited. But regulation really is for the good, even of business. I mean, I think we have to rethink this, because regulation often could work to make sure that banks don't hedge and leverage too far and so on. And so we had deregulation in many respects for banking, and we had the old rules from the back in the Depression days of the New Deal that said that investment banks and regular commercial banks should not be working in the same. But then that separation was removed in around 99, and so now they could play the games of investment bankers, the regular banks, and that's how some of our big banks got into trouble. And there's so many problems we've had with the lack of regulation regarding mortgages, regarding the rules about leveraging for the major investment banks like Goldman Sachs. It used to be they could only, you know, go 15-1 on the capital they had. Then the rules were sort of loosened up in 2004. They could go 30-1. These are the kinds of problems that have led us into the down the road to disaster, and we're trying to correct these problems now and set us on the right track for the future. So I would say, when Brian argued that we've had unrestrained capitalism, yes, we did move in that direction for a considerable period of time, and it's led us down the road to trouble.
Yeah.
And we've got to recognize it.
Randolph from Madison. Hi, Randolph.
Yeah, I wanted to refocus a little bit on the freeing up of credit issue that you was talked about a little earlier. And you mentioned that the term welfare or capitalism, I guess another way you could put it is corporate welfare. And you know, in talking about welfare, you know, when you have welfare, when the traditional welfare, you make, you know, there's now requirements of people to do something, you know, go out and get a job, whatever. Why is there not more requirements on these institutions, financial, whatever, that receive all this money for freeing up some of this money for the, you know, a good amount of it, you know, to credit freed up? And actually a main point is, I think there's a lot of fear about corporations, fear movement being the first ones to move on this and being disadvantaged. Why isn't the government able to facilitate somehow, you know, like saying, well, you know, you all got to have a schedule here of like putting out so much money, you know, all together at one time, in different increments or time increments or whatever, so that the corporations won't fear doing that individually.
All right. Thank you, Randolph, for the call.
Sure. Good point. And corporate welfare might be another term to use in this regard. It does seem that the requirements that Randolph would like to see are starting to come up as a demand. Back when we had the first sense of this crisis in the late period of the Bush administration, our Treasury Secretary Paulson, Henry Paulson, came up with a, you know, quick emergency plan. There wasn't much time to think about anything, and perhaps he should have thought it through more thoroughly, because he had sort of like a one-page description of what he wanted. Give me these funds, and we'll quickly prop up these industries, the financial industries, and everybody just, you know, give me a prayer and the money, and we'll go from there. Now, in the new administration, again, we're only, you know, a month or so into this thing, so it's not been long, and they're trying very quickly now to do exactly what Randolph is expecting, to set up schedules, and let's see this credit released, let's see mortgage owners get some help, and let's work out the terms for it. So when we're going through this day by day and we're watching the news and we think, hey, I've seen so much talk already and what's happened, not enough to satisfy me. But when you realize that these are big, big questions the government's facing, what to do, how to handle it, how to manage it, we're doing an awful lot right now and more is to come. So it requires some quick thinking and difficult actions. But he's exactly right. We're trying to set the rules up much more effectively now rather than we did in the late 2008 period when we just said, here's the money and please save the system.
Yeah. Let's look a little bit more at, you write about the money that we've given to take a financial stake in AIG. They keep coming back to ask for more. The auto companies, they keep coming back to ask for more. Troubled banks, as well as a larger commitment to Fannie Mae, because those institutions were teetering. Do you have any assurances that that this is going to go okay, or do you think that some of those are just so troubled that they might go under and they've wasted lots of our taxpayer money?
That's a great question. And in the case of AIG, just take the outstanding example, because they've been getting so much money and they come back a fourth time looking with the handout. So you wonder what's going on here. Well, Bernanke and others recognize that this is a company that has its tentacles out all over the world. Every banks and various institutions around the globe and in this country are connected with this AIG situation. So here we are pouring money and taking ownership in AIG, really, because we don't want it to fail. It's too big to fail. Am I confident that everything will work out? I don't think anybody can really say completely with the affirmative on that one. We hope it will. We hope that we'll get past the crisis, and some of these companies will be much reduced. Certainly, some are going to be nationalized temporarily. I mean, that's one of those scary words. Oh, my God, nationalized. But
right.
We've been doing this two a week or so. We've been nationalizing failed banks, usually little banks, but we've been doing it. And we've been there before, back in the 1980s, when the savings and loans failed by the hundreds. We nationalized them briefly until we could sell them off and until times turned better, and the government might even make a little profit in the effort to control this problem of sales.
Let's go to Boyd from Milwaukee next. Hi, Boyd.
Good morning, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hello to your guest. Very good show. You already touched on one point that I wanted to bring up, but the two points I wanted to bring up was with the whole healthcare system. I remember reading Earl Gustafsson's book on the Swedish system, and he basically said, and I think we need to look at healthcare in this country as, pardon the term, or maybe not, social responsibility, and you simply don't have that in this country. And I think what people seem to mistake is that what you have, certainly in Canada, and I think over in Europe, is not socialized medicine, but a socialized insurance company. And if you do just a little bit of homework, if someone wanted to go with a private provider, I know that they have them in Canada, and I know that they have them in Sweden. So I think, you know, I know, Kathleen, yesterday you had a guest on who didn't agree with the socialized method of, as he called it, of the healthcare system. He believed in competitiveness, which brings me to my next point, though. If we're going to have something like that, though, then we need to have, as your guest mentioned a few moments ago, the government intervene and be a regulator. I personally identify myself as a socialist, but I believe it's the job of the government to be a regulator in order to avoid monopolies. If you know, monopolies are really, in the end, what ruins the economic system. And I think even Adam Smith would agree with that.
Okay. Very, very good. And I think there are two points here I'd like to discuss for a moment. And that is, in the healthcare situation in this country, we all have been cheering it for so long. But now, as things have been going down a difficult road, we're starting to raise serious questions. And that's good. One is the point he made about social responsibility. We've left so many people out of the system, 43 million or so now out of our health care program and care. And then others are often off the rolls. If they get sick, they could lose their health care. So it's a big problem. And the other point is about costs. Our system costs far more than any other country system. Of all the advanced nations in the world, the American healthcare system is a gigantically expensive one. We now pay 16%. It's been growing year by year, 16% of our gross national product just for healthcare.
So it's that
productive. It's not really, you know, making goods and services in the real sense. Hmm. And so it keeps climbing, and the projections are we'll be at 20% in a short time if we are not careful. So one of the Obama programs is, of course, that we can not only bring it to more people, but we can get the system in a more rational form so that we'll save money. It's very wasteful. Quite often there are tests and procedures given that are not truly necessary. We have great conflict of interest. We have so many cases where doctors are, you know, approached by pharmaceutical companies, and they're given vacations. In the past, there are new rules for this, but they've been given the vacations. They've been given T-shirts and hats and everything else, and all kinds of things to encourage the use of particular medicines. And so decisions are made not in the best form. We need to get the system reorganized in a dramatic way, and that's why there's a lot of talk about this. And there's a lot of nasty talk about all the Canadians. You always hear these tales of the Canadians. They just want to run to America to get the good things we have. But when you interview Canadians, you discover they're quite happy with their system, which costs only two-thirds of our costs. And as the caller Boyd mentioned, in any of these systems, you always can take out, you have the freedom to take out private insurance to supplement what you have in any kind of a national program. So let's get past some of the fear factors we talk about healthcare and realize, too, that our system needs a lot of reform.
Thanks, Boyd, for the call. More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Professor Robert Toplin. He is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington and wrote a piece recently, "We Are Not Heading to Socialism." And we're welcoming your phone calls as we look at, you know, all kinds of issues, the government taking a financial stake in auto companies and banks in trouble in AIG and Fannie Mae and the stimulus package that's going on right now. He writes, our guest, "Americans remain committed to the free enterprise system, and most of them understand that in an emergency, government has an important role to play in saving capitalism from its excesses." More calls in a moment. Email, if you'd like, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, a professor of law from Duke University, our guest from North Carolina, our guest today, 34 legal experts, led by our guest next hour, have submitted a letter to Vice President Biden, to the Attorney General, to senators and representatives that detail proposed and significant changes to the role and conduct of the Supreme Court. We'll talk about what they see as problematic with the court and what their proposed changes are. Lifetime appointment is one of their concerns, so that's coming up hour number two. Back to your phone calls this hour for our guest, Professor Robert Brent Toplin. He's a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. And we go to Ray from Milwaukee next. Hi, Ray.
Hi, Kathleen, and good morning to your guests. Your guest touched on something earlier when he said we'll see success when we see 3 million jobs created. Well, right now, I'm on the lower pay scale as opposed to one of the earlier callers. I'm making $20,000 or less, and what I am seeing is corporate welfare, corporate socialism, whatever you want to call it, we are definitely seeing it. But what has allowed it to happen is the underlying structure that we've seen taking place probably since World War II, where we have allowed these companies, these banks, for instance, AIG, an insurance company that started in China and then, like a tumor, spread around the world and spread its tentacles just the way a tumor metastasizes. Now, in a living system, tumors start to draw energy away from the rest of the body, where energy is needed to be spread out evenly. And when you have tumors, you know, you either have to stop them from growing or remove them. Right now, what your guest is suggesting and what our president is suggesting, that we need to prop up these tumorous entities like the giant auto companies, the giant banks. The real underlying issue here is
they are too big to fail, and that should be a warning to us that we should not give them another cent. They should all be broken up into smaller companies. AIG could be broken up into 10,000 smaller insurance companies that could service their communities and not have to spread around the world like a tumor, like a cancer, drawing energy into themselves, like tumors bring in new blood cells, and they draw it away from vital parts of the body that need blood. Right now, we're talking about propping up these tumorous entities. What is wrong with us? Can you explain that to me?
Well, that's an interesting metaphor, the tumor that's growing here. And in a way, you're certainly right with AIG in the sense that actually it's a big company that had profitable activities in many sectors, but in one in particular that had an office in London. They were into this funny business of the credit default swaps and got into a heck of a lot of trouble and has really torn down the rest of the company. So in a sense, that is the bad tumor that grew and spread out, metastasized and all that. So you got this issue. And your idea about breaking things up into smaller units and trying to find a broad new solution, and also that's maybe one of the answers we'll be coming up with in regard to AIG ultimately. We're in this emergency crisis now where we're trying to make sure things work effectively. So that's an AIG is a huge company, and if it goes down, if we just let it go down, we said, I'm not going to give you another cent. We're just going to let you fail. And, you know, failure is just one of the aspects of capitalism. And some trumpeter said years ago that it's, you know, creative destruction. This is just the way it works. You know, you have failures and then others come up and it's the best way to go. Well, unfortunately, we've discovered that in this case, if it goes down just like, you know, from the lack of support, well, a lot of banks are counting on the protection they have from AIG insurance, in a sense, protection guaranteed. They suddenly will have their books in very bad shape, and they might go under. And we might discover that, I thought I had some funds in my local bank, and they're in just fine shape and protected, but maybe they could be in trouble. Don't mean to put the fear of disaster into the minds of all, but that's one of the reasons why we're saying we got to rescue AIG as well as we can, and we're taking extraordinary measures when you think of how many billions of dollars are going into AIG. It's just extraordinary, but we wouldn't do that unless we had this vision of a terrible consequence if it just collapsed, and we said, you know, take the pain, you made the mistakes, take the pain.
Thanks, Ray, for the call. Scott from Green Bay, hi.
Good morning. I guess maybe there's a talk of socialism or a concern of it when you have a president, and I'll quote, comes out and says that government is the only solution to the problem we have. And that's what Barack said, you know, a month ago, that government was the only solution. Not one of the solutions, not that it could help, but government was the only solution. You know, as a small business owner, let's go back to the tax policy question. In the tax policy, the $250,000 and up seems like a lot, but as a small business owner, and the majority of small businesses file under subchapter S, that's not a lot of money. It really isn't when you're running a business. And so small businesses are going to take a hit in a time when we're already under pressure because of decrease in activity, because of the economic downturn. We're going to get our charitable contributions limited to 28 cents of the dollar. I mean, there's a variety of policies that are anti-small business that hurt in an economic downtime. And back to the point about the top 2% got tax breaks over the last few years. Everybody, all marginal rates went down under Bush. Everybody got a tax break. The top 5% wage earners pay about 50% of the federal tax dollars coming in income taxes. I think we need to make this not a divisive issue where it's the rich people against, and that's what tax policy does nowadays. It's a divisive issue. I think we need to change that mentality, and small businesses, which will be the growth out of this recession, can't be in a position where they're actually going to get penalized, and that's what's happening under Obama.
Professor Toplin.
Yes, and Scott has beautifully summarized the position arguments of many of the major leaders in the Republican Party who have been placing the the criticism in this fashion, that to say that it's hurting small businesses and people who are making somewhat over $250,000 may be doing an awful lot for our economy, and they need to have the confidence to invest and to expand and to bring this economy back to life. So it's a good and important argument. Of course, we're specializing in this way and saying that it's small business. People over $250,000 may be in all kinds of situations, and maybe they're not in small business, and maybe in many other enterprises. But that's a situation that hurts, but somewhere there's got to be some give. The idea has been that it's going to cost somewhere. The tax policies have to be affected to some degree, and so, as I said before, the Obama team has judged that we'll go especially to that sector that was given the best benefits since 1999, 2000. That since that time, they've had theirs reduced substantially. So, they can take a little bit of the hit. It is painful. It is. No one likes to do it anywhere. It's just that where are you going to place it? So, Obama promised a tax cut for 90 some percent of the population, and so that's where they're going. In the sense that the feeling is that if the great majority of people will feel that they are getting a tax cut in this emergency, and others, some of it will be delayed anyway for a few years as to when the hit comes. But somewhere a hit has to occur. There's no magic formula. There's no free money here, no free lunch. That's the difficulty. I don't think the government, the leaders currently, are trying to be anti-business at all. They want to be pro-business, and what they're doing is trying in so many ways to make the future much better for business, because they realize this is not a recession. We're not in a little V situation where, it drops and then it pops up suddenly almost overnight. Everything just jumps up together and we're in better shape. We're in we don't know whether it'll be a U, where you come down and you have a flat period for a long time before you start coming up, or we are in an L, like the Japanese found themselves in the 1990s, where for maybe 10 years you're in a terrible slump. And that's why Obama said, not that government's the only thing, but I think Scott is right in that he was putting a strong emphasis on government having hopefully the potential to get this economy moving again when it's in the dumps. We don't want to be like the Japanese and accept 10 years of life in the doldrums. We want to find some way to get out of this. And because businesses, you can see it all around the country, auto manufacturers, everybody, they're all cutting back.
Sure,
people don't have confidence in the potential of expansion and all these things that Scott would very much like to see. That we all, he's so right that we need the business world to take those chances to get us moving again. But people are so fearful now, for good reasons, that they're pulling back. And so the hope is that these government programs will make folks look around and say, hey, we are moving again finally. Things are happening. People are buying again. And so that will shake us loose and get us moving.
Thank you, Scott, for the call. Andy is next from Bloomington, Minnesota. Hi, Andy. Are you there, Andy?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Yes, I'd like to talk about the hospitals and stuff and the socializing the healthcare industry. I work in the healthcare industry, and I see the social misfits, as you may, taking advantage of the system. People, I live in Minnesota, moving to Minnesota just for the social health care. And I want to know why you think that the government would have a better handle on it. And I mean, I look back at Medicare and I look at Social Security, and being 30 years old, I don't see me having Social Security when I retire or having Medicare when I retire. How is the government going to do any better with health care than they have with these organizations?
All right, Andy, a little rocky phone there, so let's go to our response.
Okay, some good issues here. Medicare, there are really two ways of talking about Medicare. One is the one that Andy is mentioning about the long-term viability of it. Will it run out of money in the future? And as we look down through the decades, we can see that in the future we need to find a solution for this. It's expensive, and so we not need to come up with some answers now. But the other part of it is just how do people feel about Medicare. Is it a success? Is it a failure? Well, ask the old folks, the gray hairs.
They like it.
They love it.
Right.
They're crazy about it. There's one joke about the old guy who says, he's a conservative guy, and he says, don't let the government mess with my Medicare. But government is into Medicare, and you wouldn't have Medicare if it weren't for government, and they're very happy with it. For Social Security, we can think of, President Bush, when he was reelected, said, I've got the mandate now, and I want to do something about Social Security. I want to privatize it, and just think how wonderful that will be. Well, we now realize, goodness, it would have involved a lot of profits for the stock organizations that get involved in that. But more importantly, those folks who expected to retire with some help from Social Security now would be in very difficult straits because they'd be reduced by perhaps 40% in what was out there for them. So there are all these problems, and social health care system, we need some action now, it seems, to bring more people
Professor Toppin,
under the umbrella.
We're out of time. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the hour. Thanks.
Thank you.
Professor Robert Brent Toplin, professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to Rob Schroeder for on-air production in our studios here in the Royce Federal Building in Milwaukee. And thanks for all of your calls. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return with more Wednesday conversation. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.